Friday, 5 p.m.
Double happy hour.
After a long, weird week, freezing cold weather, winter time in New York City, folks. Just gotta get used to it. But it is Friday. That's the good news. Weekend ahead. And it's time for American Hit Radio here on WHPC 90.3 FM, Garden City, New York. I'm Tom Ryan, Heidi Morales Ryan, my lovely wife and co-host here as well. For the How Music Changed series, which we do every Friday at this time, we are coming toward the end of our coverage of Eric Clapton. In fact, today is show number 16 in our coverage, and we're going to cover his career in the 90s, what was happening for Clapton in the 90s.
That's frightening.
It's an improvement over the 80s. that's one good thing I can say about the
telling.
90s. Yeah, well, you know, in general... You know, I've got a bit of a prejudice against an awful lot of what had happened in the 80s musically.
Yeah,
so.
There's a lot of schlocky music values.
Yeah, Clapton began to, he got over it himself, right? And that's
Thank goodness.
What this show is about. Another thing that you begin to realize, that it's around this time where I began to recognize for sure that Eric Clapton is a step apart from the average pop star in a lot of ways. I mean, most pop stars live out their dramas in public.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, he's very quiet. I mean, so a lot of what you've brought up over the episodes that we've done were news to me.
Yeah, there's so much that was happening behind the scenes in his life that it really was not common knowledge. And I don't think I would have known about him ever if it hadn't been for his own autobiography.
Right.
I mean, he certainly did his own share of living out an awful lot of stuff in public because of what happened with his son and all that stuff.
Right.
But, you know, perhaps because of the negative aspect of fame, he'd always had this, like, you know, private side and been a private person. But, you know, the nature of fame has a way of blurring the line between, you know, trying to desire to have your own life and also wanting to have publicity.
Right.
And yet it's funny because, like, after the death of his son, this is like when his fame reached an all-time high in the aftermath of that. And one of the main reasons is what he ended up doing in the aftermath of his son's death. From his own autobiography, reading this, the year 1991 was horrendous on the face of it, but some precious seeds were sown. My recovery from alcoholism had taken on a new meaning. Staying sober really was the most important thing in my life now and had given me direction when I thought I had none. I had also been shown how fragile life really is, and strangely enough, had somehow been cheered by this, as if my powerlessness had become a source of relief for me. The music, too, took on a new energy. I had a need to perform these new songs about my son, and I really believed that they were meant to be, meant to help not just me, but anybody who had or would suffer such extraordinary loss. The opportunity to showcase them came in the guise of the Unplugged TV show for MTV. I'd been approached to do it and wasn't sure, but now it seemed like the ideal platform. I sat in my house in Chelsea and worked out a repertoire for the show that would allow me to really revisit my roots and present the songs, new songs, in a safe and careful environment. Roger was like an expectant father hovering over the project, meaning his manager.
Right.
Well, I was fairly dismissive, saying that I thought we ought to put it out as a limited edition. I just wasn't that enamored with it. And as much as I'd enjoyed playing all the songs, I didn't think it was that great to listen to. When it came out, it was the biggest selling album of my entire career,
which
goes to show what I know about marketing.
Yeah.
Because it was also the cheapest to produce and required the least amount of preparation and work. But if you want to know what it actually cost me, go to Ripley and visit the grave of my son. I think that's also why it was such a popular record. I believe people wanted to show their support for me, and those who couldn't find any other way bought the album. Which is very interesting to think about, the fact that he's more or less thinking that, yeah, there might have been a sympathy factor, but it played out.
In some odd way.
Yeah, in an odd way. And of course, the song about his son was on the Unplugged album, and it got a tremendous amount of airplay. As much as I was engaged on a voyage of personal self-discovery, I was also rediscovering my roots. Having opened the door to my true musical tastes with Unplugged, I decided that it was time to say thank you to the blues and to the players and singers who had inspired me so much throughout my life, people like Elmore James, Muddy Waters, Jimmy Rogers, and Robert Johnson. I went into the studio with the approach that everything would be recorded live, and having chosen the songs, we would play them as much like the original versions as possible, even down to the key that they were played in. It was great fun, and I loved every minute of it. From that album, the album that came out after Unplugged, it was entitled From the Cradle. Here's one track entitled Blues Before Sunrise. That's Eric Clapton, of course, performing Blues Before Sunrise. It's a song written by Leroy Carr. It was an Elmore James version, though, that Clapton was emulating there.
Right, I can see what you mean about him, his material getting better in the 90s. He's going back to what he originally wanted to do.
Exactly. You know, this
from
is
the very
him
beginning,
saying,
why he always kept on being dissatisfied.
It's almost like his whole life. He's just, you know, this is really what he was probably thinking of doing the whole time. And the funny thing is, it's unfortunate, though, because the critics didn't really jump on this record with a lot of praise. And I think the reason was that they thought that Clapton was not really necessarily emulating the song so much as imitating them. Like, you hear how he changes.
He was just doing covers.
Yeah, well, covers, yeah, as close to carbon copy as he could. Like he said in the book, he was trying to, you know, he would even keep the keys the same regardless. And if, you know, he tried to play the guitar the way that it was on the track, but what's most telling is the way that he would change his voice. Like there you hear him really rasping up his voice a lot to give it like that Elmore James sound.
Right.
And it sounds, to me, it's great. You know? It's great.
He's showing his love.
Exactly. But the critics did not show love in return, unfortunately. Here's another track from the same. You know, you can't, it's funny that, you know, us, neither one of us are really huge Clapton fans per se, but it seems like the stuff that we like is like, falls out of line from what the critics have to say.
Yeah.
Well, here's from the same album. Here's another track. This one is actually a Willie Dixon tune. This is called Third Degree.
Just can't stay no more of this third degree. Taxes, I ain't got a dime. Got me accused of children, and ain't every one of them was mine. Bad love, bad love. Killing me. just can't stand. No more of this third degree.
It's crazy when you think about it, because Eric Clapton, probably more than almost just about any other pop star, if I may call him that, is so associated with the blues. Everybody thinks of Eric Clapton as a blues player.
Right.
And yet this album, which wasn't released until 1994, this is his first all blues album.
Authentic old school blues.
I mean, yeah, he'd never really made an album that was all blues before in his career.
Right.
So it's kind of, I mean, you can maybe count John Mayall's Blues Breakers, perhaps. That could have applied as being, but I mean, the stuff that Clapton did with Cream, not, of course not. The stuff that he did in his solo career.
I think that's what they were trying to do, though.
Perhaps, yeah, but the times have changed. This is Clapton very deliberately trying to stay exactly within the framework of the blues. And so I guess whether or not the critics were going to like it was dependent upon how they felt about, I guess, that in theory. But obviously, in execution, it's quite good. I think the arrangements on this
album, I think it's some of his better stuff, mainly because it is real blues.
Yeah, and even though he is emulating these artists, he does it really well. He's doing it really well and with a lot of feeling. Here's another, from the same album. Here's a blues song you might recognize. This is called Motherless Child.
If I mistreat you, girl, you sure don't mean no harm. If I mistreat you, girl, you sure don't mean no harm. Well, I'm a motherless child, I don't know right from wrong. Please tell me, pretty mama, honey, where'd you stay last night? Please tell me, pretty mama, honey, where'd you stay last night? Well, you didn't come home till the sun was shining bright. I have to go so far now to get my hand on the board. So far, girl, to get my hand on boy. Well, he's had a lot of women gonna let my hand on boy. Well, I did more for you, girl, than your daddy ever done. Well, I did more for you, girl, than your daddy. Well, I give you my jelly, he ain't giving me. And when you see two women always running hand in hand, and you see two women always running hand in hand, you can bet your bottom dollar got good. But I'm going to the river, give me a tangled rocking chair. I'm going to the river, give me a tangled rocking chair. And if the blues overtake me, gonna rock away.
Credited to Robert Hicks as the songwriter, that's Motherless Child, a song that title is used so often, it seems, in a lot of different songs, and it's not the one that I think is the most well-known version, I suppose, of other another song with the same title, I should say. What's also unusual, I mean, as I'm listening to the lyrics of that song, I'm recognizing it as something that Van Morrison had also recorded when he was on Bang Records around the time that he was doing Brown Eyed Girl.
Uh-huh.
He was on that label for a short while. That's the label that he pretty much...
Yeah, he had to try and get out of his contract.
Exactly, to
so
get
to
off
speak.
Of that label. But this is a song that he recorded in good faith before things were bad. But he recorded it as He Ain't Give You None. And I think he took writing credit for it. So it's interesting, though, because that verse is exactly identical on Van Morrison album, as it appears here.
Well, I guess he was waiting to get caught. You might have just outed him.
Sorry about that, Van. Oh, what does Eric say? From the Cradle, my new album, did very well going to the top of the charts in the States, which was pretty good for a no-frills blues record. I toured on the strength of this for nearly 2 years, playing nothing but the blues all over the world, blissfully unaware of the way the music industry was changing. I agree with that. One more track from the album, then. Here's Eric Clapton's version of It Hurts Me Too, also from the album From the Cradle. It's interesting.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this came out around the time that I had my book published, American Hit Radio, and a lot of what I was talking about in the book, I realize now, looking back at it now, that a lot of it really just came to came into fruition soon after the book came out. Not that I had like any sort of like foresight, really, or you know, I couldn't see into the future. It was rather obvious about what was happening. For example, if Eric Clapton puts out an album like that, full of really great blues songs,
right,
and yet pop radio stations felt like they couldn't touch it because it was blues. And yet when he put out his pop material, that was no problem. You know, it just seems so weird. Everything became so stratified that they would have to define things, and it had to more or less fit the mold of what their expectations were, rather than let their expectations be challenged by having something new or different. To this day, I think we're still suffering from that same problem with the radio. Maybe even worse. Well, around this time, again, I'll read, this is another very important aspect of Clapton's life that happened around this point in time. My own work in the treatment center now led to one of the most significant periods of my life. On recent trips to my house on Galleon Beach in Antigua, I had become increasingly disillusioned by the number of addicts and drunks who were springing up. Or maybe it was just that I was noticing them more now. Coming home from one trip there, I confided in Chris and Richard about this dilemma, saying that I was thinking of selling and not going back again. And they both said, well, why don't you just take the program to Antigua? I asked how I would do that, and Chris said with a twinkle in her eye, you've got the money, build a treatment center. She also said that if I were to do that, then she would advise me on running it. My immediate reply was, well, I'll build a treatment center if you come and run it. Ultimately, the object would be to build the clinic in Antigua with a view to servicing the entire Caribbean area. It was accepted that few clients would initially come in from the local communities and that we would need to promote the center elsewhere, drawing on people from America and Europe who would pay to come there and thus fund scholarship beds for the locals who couldn't afford it. It was a Robin Hood scheme, really.
That's a very yogic philosophy, too.
Yeah, take from the rich and feed the poor. Finally, we had to headhunt somebody to be the chief clinician, and the person we found was Ann Vance from the Biddy Ford Clinic in California. The more I considered it, the more excited I became by the project, to which we gave the name the Crossroads Center. It seemed like the perfect antidote to the toxicity of my love life, and I was excited by the idea of doing something to pay back for all the good times and spiritual healing I'd got in Antigua. It really has been one of the only places on earth I've found where I can completely discard the pressures of my life and blend into the landscape. Let me play a song right now, which is sort of about how this was. I mean, of course it's not, but the title fits it. It's called Change the World. This was a song that Clapton had written. It ended up in the 1996 movie Phenomenon. It also became a very huge hit for him. Interestingly, it was also recorded before Clapton had recorded it. It was actually recorded by Winona Judd.
Huh.
I don't know if many people know that, but it was Clapton's version that became a hit. Here's his version then of Change the World.
The stars, pull one down for you, shining on my heart, so you could see the truth. And this love I have inside is everything it seems, but for now.
hear a trace of Kenny Edmonds, Babyface, on that track, who's the producer, and a big hit for Clapton. At this point in time, also, he's not really. I guess he's just what a lot of people, rock and roll artists, have started to do later in their life, when you didn't really need to like make records or two albums a year. It's amazing. For example, when when you compare anything to like say what the Beatles were doing, when they would record two entire albums in a year, plus maybe three hit singles, if not
incredible.
More. After these artists like Clapton, when you hit 30, 40 years old, you start saying, one record every 5 years is enough.
That might be enough.
You begin to,
And you might be right.
And it works. You know, this like, you know, the Blues album came out in 94, the single came out in 96, and the next album wouldn't be for another 2 years in 1998. But Clapton was, like, as you said, busy doing other things. It's funny how like life and tragic events can lead to positive things in a sense. Like him opening up the Crossroads Center.
Right.
One of the things that came about because of the fact that he had time and as a result of the tragedy of his son. Well, again, reading from his book. At this point, I asked myself some very deep, soul-searching questions. What business was this of mine? What right did I have to try and bring these kinds of changes to a community that, on the face of it, just wanted to be left alone? The answer was always the same. In order to keep what I had to give it away. In order to stay sober, I had to help others get sober. This is the main principle that still governs my life today, and I had to apply it to this situation. I was in no doubt, however, that if I was wrong, or if it was simply not meant to be, I would soon find out when the whole thing came crashing down around my ears. Even though it was quite clear that many locals simply didn't get it, we decided to go ahead anyway. Then, about a third of the way into the building, I got word from Roger that the head of the Priory conglomerate in America had decided to sell his share of Crossroads Project to another healthcare corporation that had no interest in building a rehab unit in Antigua. They were either going to scrap it or sell it to me. Roger wasted no time in telling me to cut and run, because the alternative was picking up the whole thing myself, which would cost an enormous amount of money that I would probably never see again. While I knew there was no choice but for me to go ahead, I don't think Roger ever really understood the kind of commitment I felt for this. To start with, I had given my word, if only to myself, that I would finish what I had started. If I abandoned this, it would probably mean that I would never be able to return to Antigua. And by this time, we had cleared ground and were already starting to lay foundation. In fact, we'd got quite a long way into the construction, and the word was out. The other thing was, I really believed in this project. I had seen enough people who were, on the face of it, hopeless cases, turned around to start new lives as happy human beings. I knew that it would pay off, and my reasoning was that if only one person came out of there sober and managed to stay sober, then the whole thing would have been worth it. Play a track from the next album that Clapton will be releasing, from the album entitled Pilgrim. Here's a track called My Father's Eyes.
When I look in my father's eyes.
I'm like a bridge that was washed away. My foundations were made of clay. As my soul slides down to die, how could I lose him? What did I try? Bit by bit, I realized that he was here with me. I looked into my father's eyes. My father's eyes. I looked into my father's eyes. My father's eyes. My father's eyes. My father's eyes. I looked into my father's eyes. My father's eyes.
Very slick production that is perhaps in a way disguising how heavy and meaningful that song was to Clapton. I understand that he grew up not knowing his parents, not quite orphaned because he was raised by his grandparents, but he never knew his father, didn't know his mother until much later in his life. And
was it an open story that he knew that that his grandparents were raising him?
He found out. No, he didn't. It was not an open story at first. No, it was like a big... I think if you remember in the first show we talked about it, we read about from his book about how it was basically a secret from him for a long time.
Oh, and I think he overheard his aunt or something like that.
It was like an open secret. Yeah, he began to hear from like the whispering and everything that was, he began to be able to put it together what was going on. But, you know, here he is, he never knew his father and now he lost his son. So that song is more or less linking up his thoughts of Connor with the father that he didn't know and imagining perhaps that there was a way that they could be linked up somehow. It's emotional in that sense, obviously.
Mm.
As he talks about the album, he says, I had told my friend, legendary drummer Steve Gadd, that I wanted to make the saddest record of all time.
Mm-hmm.
He said he could identify with that. It was a dangerous ambition, but in the aftermath of Francesca, his previous girlfriend, it was one that I felt I could accomplish. We booked the studio and made the whole album up as we went along. The only pre-written songs I had ready were Circus and My Father's Eyes, which we just heard, neither of which seemed to have found their right incarnation yet, because they were around for quite a while. For almost a year, we worked day and night, sometimes just perfecting little guitar motifs or honing and reshaping tracks with the Pro Tools system that Simon is a master of. The result was one of my favorite albums. I poured my soul into this one, and I believe you can hear that. Every now and then, Roger would visit us in the studio, and I knew he was not happy. I don't think he liked the music much, and we were running up incredible studio costs.
I bet.
I could see his point, but I was convinced there was no other way to make this record. It had to bleed out of me until there was nothing left to be said or done, however long it took. From that same album, which is entitled Pilgrim, is a track entitled River of Tears. Thank you.
to the dusty street that I saw you on today. It's 4 miles to my lonely room. Where I'm gonna hide my face. And about half a mile to the downtown bar. Then I ran from in disgrace. Lord, how long have I gotta keep on running? 7 hours, 7 days, or 7 years. All I know is since you've been gone, feel like I'm drowning in a river. Drowning in a river of tears. Drowning in a river. Feel like I'm drowning.
away for me.
That's all right. River of Tears from the album Pilgrim by Eric Clapton, released in March of 1998. He was looking to make a sad album, and I definitely think he was successful.
Oh, boy.
In achieving his goal there. We will be back, of course, next week with another edition as we move into the new millennium, covering Eric Clapton's music. If you're interested in this series, it's a good time now for me to mention that we post all of our shows on the internet on our website, AmericanHitNetwork.com, is where you can find it. Or just search.
Turn the volume down on the Super Bowl and just play us in the background.
Right. It's not what everybody would. the world should be doing. Well, it's very easy to find. If you can find the whole series of shows, they're sitting right there. The Wednesday show is on the left side of the homepage. The Friday show is on the right. You can. There's a button on there somewhere that says "See All Shows," and once you hit that, poof, it
Pandora's
opens up
box.
Page after page after page. There's about 1,000 of them in there. Imagine that, 1,000 hours of American Hit Radio. Ay, 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 ay. Hard to believe that I even did it. Well, I'm going to leave you with another song that actually was off of no album by Eric Clapton. I think this was really just a B-side of a CD single that I had obtained. But it was something that I always enjoyed. We used to play it a lot around St. Patrick's Day when I was doing the show with John Gomez. And now the song takes on added meaning now that I'm realizing that he did this, you know, after the tragedy with his son. It probably takes on a little bit added significance for that reason. I'll leave with Eric Clapton's instrumental version of the song Danny Boy. Take care, everybody. See you next week.